We have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover this week. Starting with local and the Department of Justice having a major press conference yesterday.
Yeah, after nearly a year of a civil rights investigation focusing on the use of force and allegations of bias, of racial bias within the Seattle Police Department, the Department of Justice this week announced its findings in the investigation. And regular listeners to this show can probably guess what they found. The DOJ said that they found widespread use of excessive force and serious internal institutional problems at the Seattle Police Department. And now they expect the Seattle Police Department to work with the Department of Justice to clean up their act or else face a federal lawsuit. Now, a federal lawsuit, if it goes forward, means that the SPD could face fines or penalties or the appointment of an outsider to come in and oversee the department. Needless to say, this was not a welcome thing for Chief Diaz and Mayor Mike McGinn to hear. I understand that there was a meeting with the Department of Justice, between the Department of Justice and the Chief of Police and Mayor McGinn and a few other city officials, and that was not a polite or a happy meeting. It was pretty acrimonious, I understand.
Yeah, now it's worth talking a little bit about the specifics of what they found because it really puts into place how serious the problems are. When SPD officers use force, according to the DOJ, it is in an unconstitutional manner nearly 20% of the time. SPD officers are too quickly resort to the use of impact weapons such as batons and flashlights. 57% of the time they do so, it is either unnecessary or excessive, and SPD officers escalate situations and use unnecessary or excessive force when arresting people for minor offenses, especially in encounters with mental illness or those under the influence of alcohol or drugs, which in turn constitutes 70% of the use of force with those populations. Now, all that tells you several things. Number one, it is very much, and of course, the fact that it's a systemic problem like that tells you also that the SPD's internal mechanisms for adjudicating problem encounters like that are broken, that there is not a system of discipline for those types of encounters. In fact, they're a normal operating procedure within SPD. So there's three takeaways from this that I can see. Number one, that they are systemic problems. Number two, that it is not just procedures, but it is also training, that SPD is training its officers to behave in this way. And number three, you know, if this kind of report came down on any kind of other institution, it would mean the head of the person running that institution. I think it's time to start talking seriously about the need to fire John Diaz.
Yeah. And I want to note, too, that the DOJ is still investigating the shooting of John T. Williams. That's a separate investigation, not a civil investigation like this one, but a criminal one. And that in the Williams case, they haven't filed charges yet. They haven't come up with their findings yet, but they could eventually file criminal charges. And it's pretty clear from some of the findings in this report that the John T. Williams case in particular may have influenced the report that they just issued, because it very much looks similar to what they're talking about in their report.
Did you touch on the use of force reports that they have to fill out on the numbers? I one of the things that jumped out to me was that they filled out 1,200 plus use of force reports, and only five of those were pushed towards a review. So
it really makes you wonder. You know, they fill out a use of force report, and it looks like it gets filed in the circular file, or it just gets buried in a pile on somebody's desk. Nobody looks at it, and certainly there's no internal review. So I think that Chief Diaz, when he and Mayor McGinn wrote their sort of preparatory letter a week or two ago to the Department of Justice saying, look, we've taken all these steps to address your concerns that you wrote to us about in your November 23rd letter about the Garrity procedures. We're doing all these internal, we're setting up these boards to review use of force, and we're doing these changes in training, and we're making these revisions, et cetera. They're going to have to do a bit more than that.
They're going to do a lot more than that.
Yeah, just setting up a board of some folks inside the department to glance at a few forms, that's not going to address these issues at all.
This gives a lot of ammunition to people who have been calling for outside civilian review boards and civilian oversight of the police department, because frankly, the SPD has proven that it cannot oversee itself.
Yeah.
Moving on, the West Coast port blockade that took place beginning of the week.
Yeah, Monday, ports from San Diego to Anchorage, including Seattle, participated in an Occupy movement blockade of the different ports there, and there were also some solidarity actions in different inland cities in the U.S. West. In many ways, the blockades were successful. They did actually shut down their ports in Portland and a couple of other cities. They did not in Seattle. There was a confrontation with the police here, as in a number of other cities. There was pepper spray. There was some use of tear gas reported, some arrests.
My understanding that parts of the port of Seattle had a couple of shifts of workers sent home, but
yes,
they didn't completely shut down the port.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
But what really came out of it was a strategic schism both within the Occupy movement and then also between Occupy and the labor movement. Even ahead of the actions, there had been criticisms of it from the leadership of the ILWU, the Longshoremen's Union, which has long been one of the most militant and democratically run unions in the sort of business union model that's out there. The ILWU leadership really kind of taking offense at what really amounted to a wildcat strike effort by people who were not members of their union coming in. And I think the money quote from the ILWU head was something like, this does not constitute support. This is not helpful. That was really a kind of a critical problem, because really the Occupy movement got its legitimacy in the first place. If you remember back in late September in New York, when unions in the New York area started signing on and saying, yes, these people represent the 99%. Once you have that kind of a schism, and this is also an East Coast, West Coast thing, where those alliances have been made on the East Coast, but on the West Coast, particularly Occupy Oakland and Occupy Portland, have been a good deal more militant than some of the East Coast Occupies. It really shows a debate that's been going on within the Occupy movement in terms of which direction you want to take it, and to what extent you want to be, to use the leftist term, a vanguard, and to what extent you want to be more representative of the 99% itself in terms of including them in decision making. So it really fed into this whole question that I think a lot of people have been feeling of, okay, where does the Occupy movement go from here? You're seeing a lot of different models being taken in different cities and no real one clear direction or voice for it. And this was the direction that a lot of the West Coast Occupies chose to go in.
This is an old problem, I think, on the left, is that you get groups of activists who are not organized in a traditional manner, and then they kind of try to make connections, or a group that is more organized, like a labor union, for example, may try to make connections with them and run up against the problem of they don't know who to talk to, who the leadership is, because there is no real leadership, et cetera. And so then communications break down and there become problems in terms of strategizing and organizing.
Well, and on the flip side of that, a lot of the Occupy folks have been very concerned about the issue of co-optation, and we very much saw that with the Tea Party movement on the right last year, where what started out as a grassroots movement very quickly became an arm of the Republican Party, and people very much do not want that to happen on the left with the Occupy
movement.
Yeah,
they don't want it to do what a lot of media pundits have complained that the Occupy movement hasn't done yet, which is to form themselves up as an arm of a political party and run candidates or endorse candidates. That's not the goal of the Occupy movement, and it's very explicitly not the goal, even though the media clearly hasn't gotten that message yet.
All right. Well, speaking of parties and candidates, we had a bunch of them down at Olympia this week. And what happened there?
Well, I think the candidates actually were trying to steer as clear of Olympia as they possibly could.
Yeah.
But we had the end of the special session in Olympia, and what they did was rather than adopting Christine Gregoire's $2 billion shortfall, what they did is patched over the 2011 budget with a $480 million fix through a combination of cuts, transfers, and delayed payments. Now, you'll notice one word that's completely missing from that sentence, which is the word revenue. Yeah. There was no additional revenue that was found within the Olympia session. It was all cuts or basically accounting tricks by moving things from one pot of money to another pot of money. This really was the coward's way out. And, one of the things that we'll be talking about when we get to, our year end stuff is how this has been a constant refrain, both with the governor and with the legislature, that they are not willing to even talk about, let alone make the hard decisions. And this is what we saw once again, where people are going to get hurt because they don't want to take the political risks of having those conversations.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving on to national and, our Congress, did they, stick their necks out there this week?
Do you have a laugh track sound effect?
No,
that we
I
can...
still don't have that. I'm sorry.
We really need that. That comes up almost every week. Congress adjourning last night for the holidays after extending the payroll tax holiday by a whopping 2 months. They did the Democrats in Congress doing this in exchange for an expedited consideration of the XL pipeline, which was the Republican demand in order to move forward on this. Now, expedited consideration in this case means the XL pipeline probably will not be approved. The State Department, which has the jurisdiction over XL, since it's, you know, Canadian oil and a Canadian pipeline that's being routed through the midsection of our country, has already said that if they don't have the time to study the environmental impacts of XL properly, they will not approve it. So the Republicans, in this case, don't particularly care about XL itself. What they care about is having a campaign issue where they can bash environmentalists in the election next year. This, of course, being particularly curious because it was Republicans in the state of Nebraska who derailed this in the first place. But this really only puts off the question of extending the middle class payroll tax holiday by 2 months. We're going to have this hostage taking again probably about the 1st of February.
And it really feeds into the criticism that a lot of Americans have against Congress these days, that Congress can't get anything done because it's continually bickering over small issues or continually discussing over and over and over again the same issue. And that's clearly what's going on now.
All right. Well, then that leaves us with a holiday tradition here, which
ho, ho, ho.
End of the year, the Eat the State overhyped and underreported. Stories
yes.
for the
uh-huh.
year?
That
okay.
is correct. Yeah.
All right.
So we're going to start this week with local overhyped and underreported stories, and then we're going to move to economic next week on Christmas Eve. And then on New Year's Eve, we'll round it off with the underreported local
the
national and international,
international
underreported stories, and also the overhyped international and national stories. So let's start with hyped stories for local news. What do you got, Maria?
Well, the thing that bugged me continually this year, every time I would log onto the computer to read the news, I'd go to a local newspaper or local news site, and there would be yet another photo of Amanda Knox doing something completely normal in the city of Seattle. Here's a photo of Amanda Knox walking down the street. Here's a photo of Amanda Knox walking down the street with a cell phone to her ear. Here's a photo of Amanda Knox with a friend walking down the street talking. I got so tired of it. I just want to tell the local media outlets, leave the poor girl alone and give us a break.
Yeah, and if I ever hear the phrase Noxy again, or the word Noxy again, I'm going to scream.
Yeah.
The whole coverage of the Amanda Knox debacle, and not just the celebrity paparazzi chasing stuff that's been going on the last couple of months, but also through her trial and her release and all that, just absolutely nauseating. It is not that big a story, and certainly doesn't merit the kind of attention that it's gotten, really for the last several years, but especially this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Number two on my list of overhyped is all of the publicity for Boeing. Every time they sell an airplane, every time they sell two airplanes, Every time that
a wing of an airplane.
Yes, every time that the legislature passes a bill that's related to any business, the business climate in the state, it gets hyped as a bill to benefit Boeing.
Anytime Airbus sells an airplane.
It's
insane.
It's a Boeing story. I get tired of it. Folks, Boeing is no longer a Washington corporation. They're based in Chicago. Yeah, they've got a couple of plants here. Yeah, they employ a lot of people, but there are a lot of other businesses that employ more people, for example, state and local governments, but they don't get the hype Boeing does.
No, and you certainly don't get those kind of headlines when state and local government workers are laid off.
No, you don't.
No, you tend to get a lot of applause in the comments
section. And likewise, Microsoft gets too much coverage too. Microsoft is a Washington corporation. However, when the newspapers talk about, isn't it great that yet another lawsuit against Microsoft got dismissed in court? Let's celebrate, rah, rah, rah. And lawsuit wasn't even filed in a Washington state court, that I start to yawn and say, next, please give us some real news.
And it's remarkable how many times you've had these glowing, fawning reports over new Microsoft products. For some reason, Zunes pops into my mind.
Yeah.
That turn out to be a total bust because there are other products out there that do it better for less money and that the market embraces. It just disappears. You never actually hear the story of this product didn't work, and here's why.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on overhype that you want
well,
to touch
we've
on?
Got a ton of underreported. So,
so let's
we,
move
oh,
on.
We should mention, of course, that anything to do with TV news, you know, if you want to maintain a modicum of sanity and intelligence, just don't watch local TV news. That's all I can say. It's just chuckle buddy hell, basically.
And stories that are not news.
No. Car fires, photogenic pucky survivors, preferably kids, overcoming adversity, you're being reunited with pets.
I think the worst story I saw on local TV this year was somebody lost their wallet and then found it again. I was just like, this is not news. Why is this even on the news? I've got really upset.
It should make you feel good, Maria. And what you really need to look at yourself and your own priorities. If a story like that doesn't make you just feel good about humanity.
Oh my God.
All right. On to underreported.
Underreported. At the top of my list for local underreported stories is the absolute lack of reporting of local radiation levels in the state of Washington after the Japanese earthquake and tsunami and the event at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. This is something that people on the West Coast needed to know. They needed to know the steps to take to not be exposed and to have in particular their children not be exposed to radiation. And not only did the local media not report about it, but they didn't push the regulatory agencies in the United States, the federal regulatory agencies or the local regulatory agencies, to do any kind of measuring at all. And that's a scandal.
And to be fair, it wasn't just the local news also, it was the national news as well that soft-pedaled effects in the United States. And that's a subset of the story we'll get to when we get to national and international. The reporting overall about the Fukushima disaster
has been
just terrible.
Atrocious, yeah.
Just absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
But it was certainly happened at the local level also. One of the other things that I had as a top underreported story locally was the impact of corporate money on local elections. We got some attention to pay to just the enormous sum of money that was poured into the I-1183 by Costco. $23 million to get, is now the benchmark for a corporation to get its very own initiative passed. What was not as widely reported was that Costco did this because they expect $80 million in profits every year from its hard liquor sales. That number didn't actually even get bandied around much until after the election took place. But it wasn't just on the initiatives and the fact that the other two initiatives that were on the ballot were also pretty much single source financed in terms of where the money came from that enabled to pay the signature gatherers that got them on the ballot. But we saw that also in local elections in terms of elected office, where in a year when the school board came under an enormous amount of criticism, three out of the four school board incumbents that were up for election got re-election relatively easily. Only one narrowly was defeated, and all five of the city council's incumbents were elected, four of them very easily, and one of them, Gene Godden, who in any normal year would have been pretty decisively defeated, managed to out-fundraise her opponent by a 3-1 margin and get re-elected. Now, the reason this has to do with corporate money is that corporate donations this year were up post-Citizen United, and because of the economy, individual donations were down, and corporate donations almost always go to incumbents. It's really a legalized form of bribery. It's either paying people off for their past support or putting money on the fact that they expect them to be reelected and paying for favors and support in the future. And that's how our political system works right now. And so you can expect, particularly in the wake of Citizens United and particularly in the wake of the Costco initiative setting the benchmark for how much money can be spent on local elections, that's going to be the wave of the future until we get real meaningful election reform in this state.
Yeah. Number three on my list is the cowardice of Governor Gregoire. I mean, if you look at what she did this year, she is not going to be up for re-election as governor. It was the year for her to take some big stands and try to do some things that otherwise would be politically risky for her. But she didn't do that. In fact, she did some things that I thought were absolutely cowardly. One was to veto the medical marijuana bill. Another was to lower penalties for government agencies that withhold documents in public records requests. She also proposed an all-cuts budget. She did not propose any kind of tax reform. She didn't come out and say what really needs to happen in the state to build a sustainable revenue source is we need a state income tax, but she didn't mention anything about that. She did not propose any meaningful closing of tax loopholes, the $6.5 billion in tax loopholes that could have been taken advantage of in order to balance the budget. And she proposed researching privatizing liquor distribution in the state of Washington, which was quickly abandoned as a bad idea. And now she's announcing that, gosh, maybe we should look at privatizing the state lottery. I just see it's just an endless string of things coming from Gregoire. And, you know, I look at that and I go, whose back are you scratching here?
Yeah, it's like, you know, normally when elected officials become lame ducks and they announce that they're not going to run for re-election, that frees them to do things that they don't have to worry about getting a backlash from voters or a backlash from business or from other legislators for. In this case, it seems an awful lot like Gregoire is auditioning for her next job, and that next job is not going to be working for you and me.
Yeah, clearly. And also on my list is this year the legislature let the state's universities raise tuition without any limits, and the UW promptly turned around and raised tuition 20%. That, I think, is scandalous, given that it costs way too much now for students to get a four-year degree in the United States, not just in the state of Washington. But the fact that the legislature, instead of saying we need tax reform, we need to come up with more revenue, they basically said, well, universities, you take it out of the students.
Yeah, and this is something that's happening all over the country. It's a local part of a national story that, number one, middle-class families can no longer afford university tuition, at the same time that even having a four-year college degree is no guarantee of employment afterwards. And this is something that has been highlighted by the Occupy movement, but not highlighted nearly enough.
Yeah. Also on my list was the Seattle schools scandal came and went without leaving much of a ripple behind. You know, given the fact that Maria Goodlow Johnson lost her job over it.
Who?
and that the scandal managed to drain money not just out of the Seattle school district, but also out of other government agencies, including the Port of Seattle. You would think it would have been a much bigger deal than it was, but it came and went, and it's gone, and a lot of people have forgotten about it.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, you would think that the people who had oversight for all this, namely the Seattle School Board, would have gotten some blowback for it on the election, and they managed to escape pretty much unscathed because of downtown money.
Yeah. Also on my list if Bellingham can do it and Portland can do it, and Edmonds and Mukilteo can do it, why can't we do it? Ban plastic grocery bags. It's time. And it's kind of irritating to me that every time yet another local city, including Mukilteo, who just banned plastic grocery bags, they do it. You see a one paragraph story buried in the local section of the local newspaper. Media just simply can't cover it.
Yeah, one of the things that was on my list. We've had several instances this year where the Alaskaway Viaduct has been closed for one reason or another. In one case, for I believe it was 10 days. And you know what? It really hasn't affected traffic all that much. Now, the reason that's a story is because we've just had a $4-point-something billion, probably going to wind up being closer to
10 or 12. 10,
yeah, exactly. A billion-dollar tunnel rammed down taxpayers' throats that was justified entirely by the idea that if we didn't have that thoroughfare going under this downtown Seattle, if we went to a surface route rather than building a new road, there would be gridlock in downtown Seattle, when at the same time we're experiencing traffic that says that's simply not accurate.
Yeah. And then finally on my list, last but not least, is Seattle's cop problem. And we talked about this earlier in the show, of course. But I will also want to point out here in this context that Seattle's problem with the SPD and its use of excessive force and its racial bias is that this is not a new problem. It's not a problem that's just come up in the last couple of years or just since Chief Diaz was confirmed as the new chief for the Seattle Police Department. It's something that local social justice organizations have been complaining about for decades.
Yeah, and the last one on my list for right now is the Tim Iman factor. When we talked about the cowardice of Christine Gregoire, and for that matter, the cowardice of the legislators in Olympia, also in not considering revenue increases as a way to help forestall the budget. There's been a lot of coverage of that. What has not been a coverage is that Iman's responsible for this through the passage of the two-thirds requirement for any kind of fees or revenues to be increased, and the fact that Tim Iman's initiatives get very different treatment by the legislature than other ones do. We've also had initiatives passed overwhelmingly by much larger margins than Iman's initiatives have been passed that demand funding of K-12 education. Those initiatives are routinely ignored by the legislature, but the initiatives that Tim Iman passed, not so much.
All right. Is that it for the list?
That's it for now. We're still soliciting overhyped and underreported stories. There's a blog comment thread for you waiting for you at www.eatthestate.org, or you can email suggestions to us at editorial@eatthestate.org.
All right, 'cause I'm sure even with that, there's plenty that you're gonna miss.
Oh, absolutely, and we'll do economic next week, and then on New Year's Eve we'll do the national international.
All right.
That's a long, long list.
All right. Events coming up this week.
Yeah, several, actually three of them coming up today. Right now, until 11 o'clock, Nicholsville is doing a benefit pancake breakfast. That's at Keystone Church, 5019 Keystone Place North in Wallingford. At 12 o'clock today, Occupy Seattle is marching from Seattle Central Community College to Pike Place Market to protest the downtown mass incinerators, two of them that have been a serious environmental issue in downtown for a while. Now, one of them's planned, one of them's already operational.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that there are garbage incinerators in downtown Seattle, and that can seriously affect the air quality.
Absolutely. And then also downtown today at 1 o'clock at Westlake Park, there will be a vigil in support of Bradley Manning, the WikiLeaks whistleblower, whose pretrial hearings at Fort Meade, Maryland started on the 15th, a couple of days ago. So go downtown, participate in the Occupy Seattle March, and then stick around for the vigil for Bradley Manning.
There was actually one thing we didn't end up covering today was the developments this week that happened with the Senate passing on the bill for detaining Americans that you had touched on last week.
Yeah, I talked about that last week, and there really wasn't anything new other than the fact that the Senate passed it and President Obama backed down on his veto threat, which was not a surprise since his objections to it had to do with tying the executive branch's hands. They didn't have to do with actual civil liberties concerns at all. So not a surprise that that is going to get signed into law by the president, and we now have Congress and the president officially signing off for all future presidents and Congress on the abolition of habeas corpus.
They appear to be lockstep in that an idea.
Yeah, imagine that. Government expanding government's powers. When has that happened before?
Yeah.
All right, talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And as we mentioned, our ho-ho-ho holiday tradition of overhyped and underreported stories of the year. This is year 16, I believe, that we're doing it. Check it out and offer us your suggestions. Email us at editorial@eatthestate.org.